The Ryan Tuberty Show on RTE Radio 1. Sponsored by Sky Broadband. Get the power to do more with Sky's best ever Wi-Fi.
Kevin Power. Good morning, Kevin.
Hi, Ryan. Good morning.
It's good to talk to you. Congratulations on White City, your latest book. I loved it.
Thank you very much. That is amazing to hear.
No, it's a true story. Okay, we've got so much to discuss. And I think, before we go back into the who's, the what's, the why's, let's talk about White City and give all our friends who haven't read it yet a chance to know it a bit by giving us the nutshell take on the book, and then we'll go from there.
Yeah, so this is a novel about the son of a rich South Dublin banker. Mm-hmm. His name is Ben. He lives a life of heedless privilege for most of his life, up to the age of about 27, at which point his father, who has kind of coasted successfully through the crash and the recession and all the rest of it, is suddenly arrested for having stolen €600 million from his own bank. At this point, the tap of money is cut off, and Ben is thrown into the real world for the first time in his life. He flounders around, gets some terrible jobs, enters into a period of debauchery, and then an old school friend arrives and offers him the chance to make a fortune on a dodgy property deal in the Balkans. And that's the basic situation.
Okay, and then it ensues from there. This is what I loved about. There's several things I loved about it. One, it's eminently readable. The language is you write beautifully, obviously. But I actually had to reach for my dictionary several times because some of the words, which I love doing. And thirdly, you infused the book with something that's been missing quite a lot from a lot of my more recent Irish books that I've been reading. Particularly from younger writers, and that's humour.
Yeah, I think, as a writer friend of mine says, if it's not funny, it's not serious, and I think that's absolutely true. I'm a great believer in the seriousness of humour, if that's not a kind of paradoxical idea. And I think books make you laugh. They should make you laugh, make you cry, make you want to turn the pages. Yeah, it was very important to me to get some jokes into this book and to make it the kind of book that would give you a laugh on almost every page. I hope I've managed to do that.
You have, and I was trying to figure out what is this book reminding me of? And I was saying this last week, but I felt there was a bit of Catcher in the Rye in there. I thought there was a bit of Russell Carroll Kelly in there. I thought there was a bit of Skippy Dyes in there. I mean, it's quite an amalgam of different styles, and it's kind of almost difficult, which I presume is good news for you, to put in one spot.
And that is good news for me. I like a book, again, that's very various. That has a lot of different scenes and locations and textures and tones. I like a novel that's kind of surprising you as you turn the pages. And I hope that that's what I've done with this book.
South County Dublin. Where are we to go with that? It seems to be a fertile territory for you in terms of the people and the class structure around it. Why, given that you wrote Bad Day at BlackRock and now you're back again looking at the kind of the inane side of it all, why there? What's the intrigue for you, Kevin?
Well, I discovered that world when I went to college. I kind of didn't grow up in that world at all. I went to UCD when I was 18 to study English, And I fell in love with it. I mean, there's a line in my first book where the narrator says, you know, this is my world, these are my people, I love them and I love it. And that's absolutely true. You can't write a whole novel, especially this is quite a long novel, you can't write a whole long novel about something that you hate, I think. You have to be fascinated by it and in love with it. And to me, it seems like fertile ground because it seemed like a world that I had discovered and that not many other writers were writing about or thinking about. Now, of course, as you say, Paul Howard has come along and done an incredible job in the Russell Carroll Kelly books of writing about this world and making it funny and making it, you know, writing this kind of scathing satire. But I think, I was attracted to it because I'm interested in class, because I guess I come from a slightly, you know, from kind of lower down the class spectrum, I guess. I don't come from an elite. And I think elites are very interesting because they show us how power works. And we've seen it recently in a couple of incidents in this country. We've seen sort of how our elite functions. Let's mention Golfgate, perhaps, as one. And yeah, I think it's really important for novels. One of the things novels can do is kind of expose this stuff and think about it and show it to you in a way that's both, you know, fair and honest and interested, but also critical and stands apart and gives you the chance to kind of think about these things.
I suppose the few things to point out. One is he describes being at school, that if you're a fella in school, you're either you're part of one of the men, the book men, or the wimp men. And then he ends up having to do business with what he calls, and I love the capitalization of the letters, with the lads. And yeah. One is more of a doofus than the other. They're all pretty much horrible people. There's hardly anyone likable. Have you ever met anybody pleasant from South County Dublin? And if so, would you ever write about them one day?
One day, perhaps. Many of my closest friends, as the good thing goes.
Some of my best friends.
They really are.
Go on.
Yeah, I mean, the other thing that this book is interested in is, I guess the phrase is toxic masculinity. And what I'm very interested in is that the side of the South County Dublin world that promotes these, this jockish culture, this kind of toxic masculinity, it's very much rooted in entitlement and privilege, and it's very much rooted in being as much of a jerk as you can be, as a way of displaying that entitlement. And for me, that's both kind of sinister and also very funny, because these men are, this is a certain kind of man, and I am, you know, in that list of kinds of men you can be, I'm kind of somewhere between the book man and the wimp man, who would be the first to admit it.
That's why we're going to get on so well, Kevin.
Yeah. Well, I didn't want to say it. You said it.
Go on.
One of the major things that I wanted to write about was that kind of man. You know, they're kind of, they're pumped up, you know, they believe that they're kind of walking around as if they're already in a fight. You know, we all know these kind of men, and they're kind of coming in with their an aura of physical aggression around them, and this is how they kind of establish their dominance. But at the same time, they're kind of really, on one level, deeply insecure, because why would you go around spoiling for a fight unless you were kind of frightened, and, you know, unless you felt kind of weak?
Yes. Kevin, for some of them who've been to these schools, the fact that they were at that school is often all they have.
Yeah, that's. I remember when I first began to kind of meet these guys when I was at college, and I remember going to a friend's house, and he took me upstairs and opened his wardrobe and showed me he still had his school uniform there, sort of preserved and plastic. And I thought, well, that's weird, because I went to a community school and I think I burned my uniform as soon as I left the gates, you know, on my final day.
Yeah.
But the idea that you would have loyalty to a school in that way is, to me, very interesting, because it is not the kind of culture I grew up in, and it's not the kind of experience I had at school. Now, I went to a good school and I had wonderful teachers and so on, but there wasn't the same sense of institutional loyalty that these institutions promote.
But and we bring up his name again because I spoke to him only quite recently. But Paul Howard talked about being from a working class background, being intrigued by these creatures in these schools, and then not quite falling in love with them, but certainly seeing them more as in a more human way than in the way I think he fully intended to when he started writing about them.
Yeah, so, it's funny the way... Yeah. Sorry, go.
No, please.
Yeah, it's funny the way the Russell Carroll Kelly books get warmer and warmer as they go on, which I think is one of the reasons they're so good, because they begin to find... They present this much more rounded portrait of this world. I wanted to do the same thing, and that mainly I do that with Ben, the main character, who goes from being, you know, a privileged and heedless and really quite obnoxious, I think, character. At the end of the book, this is about learning to be a man for him in a new way, in a way that involves nurturing and in a way that involves taking responsibility for, you know, your own life and your own experiences and behaviors. And this is precisely the kind of thing that's not promoted by that toxic, you know, jockish culture.
Yeah. I felt exhausted by the amount of drugs that were being taken in the book. And that's not a criticism. You write it like in a way that, you know, you feel like you were on a chaotic weekend, I'm sure. And there's a lot of it. Is there any reality in the relentless amount of drug taking? I know it's obviously exaggerated for Ben necessarily, but is that from your own not personal story, but at least research or knowledge?
Yeah, I mean that's without sort of throwing anyone under the bus. Yeah, there are a few people that I drew on for that. Yeah, I mean, it's one of the things that drugs in fiction often appear as is a kind of metaphor for corruption, or like Al Pacino in Scarface, burying his face in a pile of cocaine on the table in his office. But for me, they're in this book anyway, they're about denial. They're a way for Ben of not looking at the truth of his life, the truth of his relationships with his parents, his friends, and they're a way of not taking responsibility for his life. And that's why he kind of canes it so hard, because he's running away. And that's, for me, the drugs are partly a source of comedy. They're partly a source of, a way of disturbing the reader and giving them a new perspective. But mainly, yeah, they're there as a way of talking about the ways we all do this. We all kind of have various strategies for not looking at the painful things in our lives, and this for me was one of the most kind of potent ones that would work as a story.
His mother is never without a gin or a glass of Chardonnay in her hand, regardless of the time of day. I think at one stage you described her having the eyes of a stuffed fox or a stoat of some sort. the glassy eyes. I go, wow. The book is full of beautiful metaphors and similes and language. I mean, constantly I nearly had to put the book down and say, that was amazing what you did there. So it's such a joy to read. I really mean that. But the dad is an interesting one, because of course he's fine. He doesn't read like any figure in Irish cultural or business life at all, Kevin. what we do have is somebody who basically took the country for a massive ride, or is accused of, and his relationship with his son, our protagonist Ben, is one of those. It again is kind of cold. It's sad. It's the sort of thing that a good relationship with your father or with anyone in your family, money can't buy.
That's absolutely right. Yeah, and one of the things that this book is about is exactly he Ben has a kind of dad who doesn't offer a good model. He doesn't offer a good way to be a man, and he has to end up. And this is not a spoiler, because he starts the book in rehab. He had to end up in rehab talking to his counselor, Dr. Felix, to find a good model, a good way of being a man who's kind of nurturing and kind, but also takes no nonsense. And one of the things that happened while I was writing this book was that my own dad passed away. Unfortunately, and he for me has always been that figure of the kind of, he offered me a way of being a man that was nurturing and warm, and that had nothing of entitlement or aggression about it. That, that's one of the, he's been one of the most informing presences in my life about how to be a man. And my wife and I have just had a son.
Congratulations, Kevin. Yeah,
thank you. Yeah, he's 5 weeks old. And I'm hoping, really hoping, that I can do a similar job for him, that I can offer him ways of being a man that are not, embedded in all this kind of toxic stuff.
Do you think the class situation, the class system in Ireland is alive and well, and by well, I'm quote unquote, or do you think it's receding or dissipating, or is it just going to just keep ploughing on?
I think we'd like to think it's receding or dissipating. No, I think it's still very much there. I think it's there in every country. And there are some countries are more open about it than others, and some countries are more comfortable about talking about it than others. We, I think, are still uncomfortable talking about it. And that's interesting to me as a novelist, because when you find something, when you find a subject that people aren't comfortable talking about, you should be writing about that. That is the kind of story that's worth telling, because it's going to tell you what kind of country you're living in, what kind of country you're writing about. I mean, I think class has changed in Ireland a lot in the last three decades. The Celtic Tiger kind of brought everybody up, or seemed to bring most people up, into a kind of new middle class. And there, that's changed how we vote, and it's changed how we vote in referenda. These things are still unfolding. But at the same time, the upper middle class is the people who control our elite institutions, are still very much there, and that has not changed, I think, in a very long time in this country.
Why do you think, Kevin, it makes for uncomfortable discussion, a class in Ireland, even in 2021?
Well, because nobody likes, first of all, to acknowledge where they themselves are or think they are in any class system. Mm-hmm. Nobody wants to say, well, I belong to the elite, because that's going to alienate you from a lot of people. And similarly, nobody wants to say, well, I'm squarely in the middle. So there's a kind of unspoken discomfort that we all experience when we think about who has the money and who has the power and who has the education, and where we are, so we ourselves are located. And that there's a lot of interesting anxieties there that I think are really rich material for fiction, and also very much worth thinking about as you know, nationally, to kind of have a national conversation about this stuff.
I want to go briefly back to Bad Day in Black Rock, which you wrote in 2008, published in 2008, I should say, and that became the movie What Richard Did. So there was a massive fuss around that and great celebration of the writing around that, and rightly so. And now we're in 2021, so there's quite a gap between your two books. Do you put that down to one thing in particular, or was it a series of unfortunate events, or how would you describe the hiatus?
I was very young when that book came out, and I was very, I kind of lived in books, and I wanted to, you know, I wanted to be a writer more than I wanted to be anything else. I thought that was the meaning of my life, and then I published a book, and it did quite well. And suddenly, you know, all of my kind of daydreams had been, seemed to have been, you know, fulfilled. It seemed that my dream had come true. And that's actually quite a dangerous position to be in psychologically, because suddenly you have all these pressures that weren't there before. And yeah, when I went back to the desk and tried to write, I suddenly found that I didn't know nearly as much about writing fiction as I thought I did, and I had a long way to go in terms of learning how to write the kind of novel I wanted to write. And I wrote, you know, three novels that I knew were bad, that I didn't even show to publishers because I knew they were bad. And that was, I spent a long time learning the ropes, I guess. Yeah, really just trying to learn what is a very complicated set of skills. Writing a novel, writing the kind of novel I wanted to write, requires a lot of skills that I just didn't have. And that, I think, is the major explanation for why it took so long.
What is that like, you know, marching through one, two, three novels, knowing in your heart that they were, as you say, you knew they were bad? That must be dispiriting.
Yeah, dispiriting is the word. And I did. I got extremely depressed at points, and I got extremely, you know, extremely kind of cynical about the whole business. And I thought, well, I'm wasting my time. I'm never going to publish another book. Why did I ever want to be a writer? You know, I did go through some quite kind of bleak periods. Mm-hmm. But I have a wonderful agent, Marianne Gunn O'Connor, who mm-hmm. never lost the faith and would check in with me and believe that I would do it. And also my wife and my family were incredibly supportive, probably past the point where it made sense. It became an act of faith, probably, to believe in me past a certain point.
But I
think you need that. If you want to do something like write a book, you cannot do it on pure individual will. You have to have people around you to help you. And you know, I was very lucky to have that.
And did your confidence take a kicking?
Oh yeah, for about a year, or about 2 years, I think I couldn't think of myself as a writer. And like, I thought, you know, I'll never be able to do the thing I most want to do. And you know, that was a painful thing to come to terms with. But in a way, what helped was that I did come to terms with it. And I said to myself, look, if you never do this, what does that matter? If you never write another book, does that matter? You have people you love. You have work that you find meaningful. You know, it does. And in a way, I think that was what freed me, because it became less important to write a book. It became just something I was doing among other things.
And then when you started then, say, writing White City, did you when you knew the other ones were bad, did you have a feeling about this one? Did you think, oh, yeah, I've got your mojo back?
After a while, it took a while. I started writing it without any particular hopes for it, basically because I just had the idea. And then after about 70 pages, I wrote and rewrote the first 70 pages over and over again because I couldn't get them right. But at the same time, I thought it's worth doing because I think there's something good here. Then I got up around page 70, page 100 after about a year or two of work. And I thought, okay, all right, I think there's something here. I think if I can finish this, somebody else other than me and my immediate family might want to read it.
That for sure. And the rest. Let's take some text. Kevin Power joining us on the line this morning. Anne-Marie says, has Kevin been watching Schitt's Creek? Although a lot lighter than his book, the theme is similar and it got me through lockdown because it's very funny. I don't know if that means anything to you at all, Kevin?
Oh, yes. Oh, I've watched it, absolutely, yeah. And it's a show about class, and it's one of the things that that makes it so funny is that it makes you look at class differences and find comedy in them, finds the discomfort in them, finds the anxiety in them. Yeah, absolutely.
Interesting interview on classes, Noel, in Dublin. Very interesting subject. No one wants to be working class, even though most of us firmly are there and should be proud of the same. Everyone who wants to be middle class but fails to realise that pay levels with old middle class jobs are no more. Most trades will provide a better income than the traditional, good, secure, pensionable job. Another says, totally agree with Kevin on the class story. Elite in Ireland, says another, is money. And Maureen says, down the country, our children go to schools with every class. They have no option, as boarding schools are non-existent. They play sport with every class and they have a much more rounded education as a result. Joan says, elite is an interesting concept. It's certainly not nouveau riche. I don't like the word even. Class is different. It's not money. It's manners, really. And Teresa says, does Kevin believe that there is a class system in Ireland? Aren't we all peasants, really? Isn't it really only money and the inside knowledge and contacts, generations of privilege? Does Kevin get hate mail from South Dublin entitled classes? My 17-year-old daughter had college advice from her well-travelled American friend that studied in Dublin. The advice was stay in Cork, as the Dublin colleges were full of cold, unwelcoming, narrow-minded, money-obsessed kids. No consequences for bad choices. Always rescued by their folks. We have two schools in Cork that has pretensions to South Dublin, so we aren't immune. Looking forward to reading White City, says Teresa. I mean, it's a bit early, I suppose, to see what reaction you were getting, but not from Bad Day at Black Rock, of course. Did you get any adverse reaction to any of these things?
Not directly, no. Okay. But that's not the way we operate in Ireland. We don't do direct negative reactions. We do it all kind of through the grapevine, or we do it through
online.
You know, that kind of, or online. The valley of the squinting windows is still very much with us. It's just moved to the internet. Irish people are very indirect in the way that they distribute criticism. Let's put it that way.
I have to break that down now. They're indirect in the way they distribute criticism.
Yeah, so they pass it along. They pass it along. They find, so you hear that so-and-so sort of didn't approve of your book, or, you know, yeah. So I got a few kind of third-hand messages like that.
Because you're in UCD now yourself, aren't you? You're teaching there.
I'm in Trinity.
Well, excuse me, sorry. Trinity. And when I suppose you see, do you not, all that class scenario writ large there, be it in the car parks or the canteens or the bars or the pub?
I suppose so. I mean, as someone who teaches there, I don't spend a whole lot of time hanging around the pub. I'd probably look a bit weird if I did. Universities are one of the ways, they are one of the institutions through which privilege is, you know, created and maintained. They absolutely are. And I think I occupy a sort of ambiguous position, because I have both benefited personally from universities, kind of, they allow you to join a certain elite if you kind of become educated, and that's certainly true of me. But on another level, I feel like an outsider in them, because I didn't come from the kind of family where everybody went to university as a matter of course. You know, it was very much, you know, so I feel I occupy a kind of an ambiguous position, whereas I'm both sort of an insider and an outsider. I've been an uncomfortable insider, I think would be the way to put it.
Sure. Just last comment on White Cities, because the Ben and the lads head over to do a big deal in Serbia. Funny, I should have been talking about that in a more serious context early on in the programme, as it turns out. But and there's a serious strain to the story there towards the end also. But their shenanigans over in Serbia is twofold. One, endlessly amusing. And two, I wouldn't suggest you'll be getting a call anytime soon from the Serbian Tourist Board.
I don't think so. No.
No.
I think I'm on their no-fly list now But I spent a week in Serbia in 2010, and it was one of those kind of memorably awful and crazy holidays or trips where you know all the food is bad and, you know, everybody's rude to you and this kind of thing. But it's in many ways a beautiful country, and I met some wonderful people there. So I put a little note at the end of the book where I said this Serbia in this book, you know, probably shouldn't be confused with the real country of that name. And I think it was important to note that I took some negative experiences that I had and exaggerated them to make a kind of because, you know, you want to put your character through hell. I wanted to put Ben through a kind of hell, and that this was the material I used to do that.
Yeah, and equally the kind of under the radar arts scene in Dublin, courtesy of Ben's girlfriend, get a kind of a drubbing too in a most droll way. Anyway, I could be here all day talking about it because I loved your new book, Kevin. Congratulations on White City. It really was a joy and a riot and a much needed bit of humour in the literary world. Welcome to that. Congratulations to you.
Thank you so much, Ryan.
And we'll see you in real life soon, I hope.
I hope so.
Looking forward to it. All right, that's Kevin Power there, author of White City, which is available now. Be sure to get it from your local bookshop if you can, rather than going international, because we've got to keep the bookshops alive and well, must we not? Right.